Welcome back, everyone, to the Medieval Irish History Podcast. To support the podcast, please recommend it to your friends, and you can also rate the podcast on Spotify or Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. Now, there's so much human drama in today's topic that I'm not sure how I'll handle it. I'm a little bit daunted by it, but let's just see how we get on. Today's subject was chosen partly because of the date and partly because it is one of my favourite single events in Irish history and should be everyone's. This week is the 1010th anniversary of the epic Battle of Clontarf and the death of Brian Boru, a man with too many adjectives for me to be able to pick one, but maybe my guest today might be able to help me, and that is medieval historian Dr. Dennis Casey. Welcome, Dennis.
Thanks very much, Niamh.
Happy to have you back on. Oh. You had a little cameo in the Christmas bonus episode.
And the outtakes.
Yeah. So, Dennis, you've published on loads of things, and I can link to your website in the episode notes, but I especially loved your work on the excellent Trinity College Dublin Millennium Commemorations of Clontarf back in 2014. And that's 10 years ago. It was celebrating the 1,000-year anniversary of the death of Brian Boru, as I said, and of the battle. And you produced a gorgeous exhibition and a booklet with Emmy and BAFTA winning Irish animation company, Cartoon Saloon, which a lot of people will know from Oscar nominations and things like The Book of Kells and Puffin Rock and stuff. I have kids that age, so Cartoon Saloon is like pictures from my life. So anyway, you've published on Brian Boru, especially his sons Donuchad and Tadhg, and also the main literary depiction of the Battle of Clontarf that we've mentioned a couple of times in different episodes of the podcast, and that is the Cugaghaelray Gallif. Now today we're going to be touching on really huge topics that have rightly attracted masses of attention from academics. And I will include links in the episode notes to like works by Sean Duffy, Moira Niueni and Claire Downham. So just a little bit of background there before we get stuck into it, Dennis. So the Battle of Clontarf, for any of you who don't know, it took place in Dublin, supposedly in Clontarf, in the year 1014. It's been traditionally framed as a famous battle between the native Irish and the Viking foreigners, in which Ireland's greatest king, Brian Boru, defeated the Scandinavian invaders. And it was something that was kind of taught to us all in school, and it really looms large as kind of one of the most famous incidents in Irish history, rightly so. Now, we're going to see that it wasn't as simple as all that, and that there was actually Vikings and Irish fighting on both sides of the battle. And while I teach it here in Maynooth as part of a Vikings module, in fact, the battle probably had more to do with Irish kingship and shifts in the political landscape than any external factors. It's one of those very rare singular events in history which kind of loads of issues came to a head. You know, so it acts as an excellent prism through which to view many massive themes such as xenophobia, national identity, toxic masculinity, toxic femininity even. And the key players are just all so fascinating and juicy. You have the sublime display of military might, the thirst for domination and power, not to mention the soap opera levels of family drama, brother versus brother, etc. I've said many times in the past, I don't understand how a Hollywood blockbuster hasn't been made about it yet. Maybe we can discuss that at the end, Dennis, of the podcast. We can talk about that in detail. We can pitch it to all the Hollywood execs. Anyway, okay, Dennis, I'm not sure what approach you think is best, but will we start off with a quick introduction to both sides in the Battle of Clontarf and then take it from there?
What yep, sure, no problem. One of the things you mentioned there is this idea that it's the native Irish versus the horrible foreigners. Mm. And of course, that is the way it was pitched in the literature from very early on. If we think the literary text from the late 11th, early 12th century, written within about 100 years of the battle, is called Cugaghaelray Gallif, the war of the Irish, the Gaelic, versus the foreigners. So they were already pitching that idea that this is what has happened. But of course, as you said, it's a lot more messy. There's a lot more people who are very heavily related with each other. And of course, that's what happens in medieval battles anyway. Generally, you know who you're fighting, and your chances are you're related to who you're fighting. And of course, that happens in modern warfare as well. I mean, if we think of World War One, most of the crowned heads that were involved in World War One were grandchildren of Queen Victoria. I mean, half of them could have donated a kidney to each other. They were so closely related.
And across, like the World War One, and across different jurisdictions as well. Mm. So not just in Ireland. It's kind of where you have the aristocracy.
Oh, that's what I mean.
Class,
yeah,
they're exactly. A class on their own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you look at the images of Tsar Nicholas II and King George of England. They're identical. Yeah. I mean, look at them. It's almost like you asked ChatGPT or AI to create an image of another one.
And then Wilhelm just doesn't have the beard.
Yeah, he just needs a better beard. Yeah.
Okay. So
But they're intimately related, yeah. Certainly. So
on the so-called Irish side.
So for anybody who's listening and has access to Maureen Evaney's book, Brian Boru, Ireland's Greatest King, published in 2007. In the appendix, she has a table of who's on which side, depending on which source you're reading.
Oh, nice.
Because depending on the sources, different people are on different sides, or more people are involved on particular sides, because as the battle gets famous, more people want in, because it's a primal moment. So it's a bit like the GPO in 1916. If everybody who said they were there was really there, the place would be bursting at the seams.
Okay, so then who can we say was definitely?
Okay, so we're looking on one side, Brian as the claimed King of Ireland. Mm-hmm. His army seems to be mainly made of Munstermen, mm-hmm. Many reluctant Munstermen. South Connacht as well, the territory of the Evania would have been around kind of South Galway.
Okay.
And probably because I think, off the top of my head, his son and perhaps his designated heir, Murchad, Murchad's mother, probably Brian's first wife, was from Evania. So they seem to stay
close
loyal
ties.
To him.
Yeah.
It shows the fragility of kingship as well, that by the time he gets to Clontarf, he doesn't have the massive armies that he had on his other circuits of Ireland beforehand, when he's displaying his military might, and he every time he goes on a massive circuit of Ireland to cow the other kings, like he's got major armies. He seems to have a lot fewer people with him this time, and some of the people that we might have expected to be allies are not there.
Like who?
We see the Osria, so the people who give their name to the what's now kind of Laois Kilkenny, the Diocese of Ossory. They're essentially not there, and they ambush them on the way home.
Yeah.
So
he has the Southerny now. Does he have?
Does he?
Has,
that's the question. You know,
we're throwing this
so
out
depends
there
on
away.
The source as well. And did they double cross him? And there's a kind of the literary sources are kind of.
Does he not have Mael Shochnall? King of Tara.
He's not on the battlefield.
Okay,
if we, look at the list of dead, there's no Southern Enail dead in the annals. So if they were there, it's very unlikely they would have come off unscathed.
But let's say then, though, he does have Munster in South Connacht, mm-hmm. The Limerick Vikings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. More than likely. Yeah.
Yeah. What's going on with the Northern Enail?
Generally, they...
What we're naming here for everyone is kind of a lot of the kind of the big kind of kingdoms and mm-hmm.
so
dynasties in political forces in Ireland mm-hmm. at the time, which we'll can get onto. But Brian had in theory mm-hmm. brought under his control the preceding 2 decades.
Yeah. And kind of shows the fragility of that none of them are there.
Yeah, you can't hold on to that for.
And when he goes to Clontarf, I mean, he had been fighting heavily that winter beforehand. Mm. So I'd say he's actually gone to Clontarf in a much weaker position than the popular narratives would have us imagine.
Interesting.
That.
Okay.
I'd say his support is slipping away in 1013, the year beforehand.
The
already.
Year beforehand. Okay. And that's probably emboldened
the Dubliners to try their hand.
So who's on the other side? The Dubliners.
The Dubliners, you've got Sitrick Silkenbeard, the King of Dublin. Wonderful name. And if you actually look at the coins he meant, he's clean shaven.
Yeah. But they were earlier, maybe. Are they about 9? Yeah. He might have had a good beard by the time 1014 came around.
Maybe he wasn't old enough to have a decent beard. He's got something shiny and like some sort of L'Oreal ad.
Yeah, flaxen, straight. Yeah. Well, they were into their mm-hmm. beards.
I mean,
as we're talking, literally as Dennis and I are talking, Jago is like stroking his beautiful locks. It's so funny. It's definitely been implied. He's like, Citric Silkenbeard.
Tiago Silkenbeard from now on will be on sound.
Anyway, okay, so Citric Silkenbeard.
Who's the King of Dublin. King of Dublin. Also Brian's son-in-law. Because he
Brian's
married,
son-in-law.
Brian's daughter.
Yeah. And he
Citric's
is also...
Citric's mother is also Gormla, who is traditionally seen as an ex-wife of Brian, but... Maybe they were still married.
I'm with you on this, Dennis. I'm not sure exactly. She's either ex-wife or current wife. It's definitely not clear. Hmm. So we've Citric, and who are his allies?
His allies then, he's got the
Is he the main protagonist of that side?
Well, depends on kind of, again, which sources you're looking at. Is it a fight against the Leinstermen, the North Leinstermen, who are led by Gormla's brother, Maya Mora?
Yeah, is this actually just Munster versus Leinster?
The Dubliners are involved, and there's assistance from the Irish Sea, which suggests that there's more to it than the, and that probably leads into the whole Gal kind of thing. Right?
Yeah. So he has with him kind of, what are the big names? So he has Maol Morda, who is his uncle, and the King of Leinster. He's in a bit of a weakened position at this point as well, Maol Morda.
Leinster are never strong, to be honest.
They couldn't get it together until Dublin decided to rise and dominate.
Yeah, it's a bit like the football championship, really.
That's exactly what, oh God. Okay, better not get into it.
Okay, so the kingship of Leinster, and Leinster essentially is, when we call it Leinster, for modern viewers, or listeners, even, Leinster essentially stops at the River Liffey.
Mm.
So it's probably half what we now consider the modern province of Leinster.
Because then you have the Southern Inale above that. And,
So the Leinstermen are essentially led by Maol Morda, who's king of, based in northern Leinster. So you're looking at really the heartlands around the Kildare region. So alongside them, you've got Citric and the Dubliners, and they're, patrimony, as it were, is reasonably small. It's probably around the size of County Dublin, give or take.
Okay.
You know. But they have access to the Isles in many respects. And we have to think of the Irish Sea as a unifying entity. That it's a hell of a lot easier to travel from Dublin to the Isle of Man to Ulster to the Western Isles as far as Orkney than it is to travel from Dublin to Galway. It's a lot easier to go by boat, and that's why places that are connected by sea are so important to this story.
Yeah.
So the big question is the Earl of Orkney one of the protagonists in the battle? And he's there in some sources, not in others.
I love that you've straight away thrown in a question mark over basically everyone who
was involved.
So Brian is definitely there.
Okay. Doesn't go home anyway.
Or he's definitely involved. Definitely gets killed. But on his side as well, when we're talking about some of the kind of the big personalities or the, you know, important kind of legacy characters, are his own, so his son and his grandson to a lesser extent, but in terms of legacy, I suppose his grandson. So they're also, so his two sons, so Dunachad, his son by
Gormla,
who, so his brother is Citric, his half-brother is Citric. He's on the on one side. Mm-hmm. So you've brother versus brother. Again, half-brothers, they wouldn't have grown up in the same household. So Dunacha's son, and then his kind of consigliere, his older son, Murchad, is fighting and is killed on Brian's side.
And Murchad's son is there as well. So, I mean, the description of Murchad's son dying is very dramatic. He dies in the Weir of Clontarf, impaled on a piece of wood with a drowning one Viking in one hand and one Viking in the other hand. As he's being drowned and impaled, he still manages to hold them both down and drag two more with him. Yeah. Not bad for a 15-year-old.
Okay, so wait now, the way we're looking at this now, who won? I mean...
Oh, big question, isn't it?
Yeah.
Who won on the day? Who won overall?
Okay, so let's start with who won on the day.
Mm-hmm.
When did it take place?
Mm-hmm. So it seems
Where did it take place?
Yeah. So it seems to take place on Good Friday 1014. We can be reasonably sure of that from the annals.
And that was apparently April 23rd, which is why I am commemorating it now.
Or you can pick any Good Friday you like. So apparently
That's why I'm going with April 23rd. But anyway,
And of course the religious semblance of Good Friday, like, and the dying Brian is a Christ-like figure for Ireland.
But do we have any reason to doubt it, or are we happy to go with Good Friday?
I think it's reasonable enough.
Okay.
So the date, we be reasonably sure of. The place is more problematic.
Yeah.
Where Clontarf was then, where it is now, did it all take place in Clontarf? Might arrange. And people will, if you look at, location is discussed in detail, for example, by Sean Duffy, and it could stretch anywhere into the Talca River area.
Where and he has great maps and everything as well, Sean Duffy does. Yeah. So,
the chances are it was roughly named. And
contemporary accounts don't actually say Clontarf.
That's what I was about to say. Yeah. I think off the top of my head, they're not...
But I think Clontarf is mentioned quite quickly then afterwards in other sources.
Yeah.
The tradition builds up. It's an old tradition.
Yeah, it does start. I mean, it's certainly there by the time Cogha has been written within a century.
Yeah.
What we can say from all these sources anyway, it seems to be a battle that happens outside. So it's not a siege of Dublin.
Mm.
It's a battle that happens out on the open plain, suggests that people were getting ready for this, rather than this wasn't just an impromptu thing.
Yeah.
It was in the pipeline.
Yeah.
And of course, if there is a contingent coming from the Isles and so forth, that takes planning.
Everybody knows
that something's building, something's rumbling.
How long before the actual battle have those ships come in? Are they there?
Even with battles, where do they take place? Very hard to find the smoking gun, so to speak. Generally, battlefields, pre-modern battlefields, don't leave much of an archaeological evidence.
And then the later stories as well have the tradition that it was partly, anyway, fought on the strand, on the beach in Clontarf, which is so dramatic the way it's described. And if you've been to Clontarf, or as I say, essentially to any kind of strand in Ireland, because I live over in the other side of Dublin Bay, and I look over, and I imagine all the Viking fleets coming in around Howth and coming in the drama, and you can just imagine the music soundtrack behind it, something was really building, but anyway, but the tides are really extreme, especially depending on spring tides or neap tides or different things, depends on the particular time of year and the particular day, but there's a massive difference in low tide and high tide in loads of different kind of beaches around Ireland. If you try to go for a swim at the wrong time, you're going to be, walking out 500 yards and it's only up to your ankles.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Whereas at a high tide, you can jump in. So it really, to me, knowing the area, the way it's kind of dramatically described as they're fighting for so long that the tide starts to come in, or also when the tide would have been going out, and that the ships are there, that rings true to me. Mm. Or maybe it was just built up for dramatic effect, but the tradition.
It's certainly physically possible.
Yeah.
But one would expect that the Dubliners would have known about the tides in their own strand.
You know. That's such a good point. They were like, okay, lads. Yeah.
And if the seafaring Irish Sea contingents come along, and if they're there for more than 24 hours, they will have had a sense of how far in and out those tides go.
But we do have references, and I don't have them to hand, in earlier annals, generations before, whatever, sometimes of battles taking place on beaches and of people getting drowned and that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah,
so potentially it was a tactic. Maybe they were pushed that far.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I suppose the main thing is we don't actually have any archaeological evidence of exactly...
No, I had a cousin in Clontarf who was convinced he knew where Brian Boru was killed, because there was one shop that always failed. Whoever went into that building, the shop would always fail within 6 months. So he was convinced it was cursed and that's where Brian Boru was.
Oh, that's brilliant. Good. That's as good as
evidence. Yeah, as good as
evidence than anything else.
Okay, I think we can wrap up the podcast now.
Yeah. I will actually, just for the sake of it, read out what the contemporary source says, because as you have rightly pointed out from the get-go, it's actually there are no facts almost that we can establish, except that Brian Boru was killed there and was there, but everything else is so coloured by kind of later reports, literary stories, interpretations and stuff. So I will just read out, I think it might be worth, just if everybody just bears with me, the Annals of Ulster entry for what the Battle of Clontarf was. Okay, so it's one of our most trustworthy contemporary sources, but the Annals have many problems of reliability and bias and everything themselves, but it's a contemporary account anyway. Okay, so it says, Brian, son of Kinnadig, son of Lorcan, king of Ireland, and Moel Shachnal, son of Donal, king of Tara, led an army to Autlia. Okay, so the contemporary account is putting them together. All the Leinstermen were assembled to meet him and the foreigners of Autlia. And again, as I've said in the earlier podcast with Claire Downham, they were not foreign, like they're in Dublin at that, by that stage, they'd been there for generations. And the foreigners of Autlia and a like number of the foreigners of Scandinavia, to the number of 1,000 breastplates, we can take that as just a random guess. A valiant battle was fought between them, and the like of which has never before encountered. Then the foreigners and the Leinstermen first broke in defeat, and they were completely wiped out. And the Leinstermen, they were like the big losers on the day, really, aren't they? Like, they did get fairly hammered, Leinster. Anyway, there fell on the side of the foreign troop in this battle Moel Morda, son of Murchad, king of Leinster, Donal, son of Fergal of the Farta, the son of Olive, another loads of like Olive, son of Lagman, Broder, who slew Brian. So Broder, who slew Brian, is named in the earliest account we have in 1014, i.e. chief of the Scandinavian fleet, and 6,000 who were killed or drowned. On the Irish then side, there fell in the counter shock Brian, over king of the Irish of Ireland. So again, like this, you know, it's very strongly worded. Over king of the Irish in Ireland and of the foreigners and of the Britons, the Augustus of the whole of Northwest Europe.
Exactly.
Oh my God.
That's not undersell.
Like, Brian is king of the world, essentially.
A bit like Homer Simpson saying, like, you know, wow. I don't want to oversell it, but it'll be bigger than 10 Super Bowls.
Oh my God. Like, the Augustus of the whole of Northwest Europe. His son, Murchad. And then Murchad's son, Turlough, son of Murchad. Then we have, yeah, the heir designate of Munster, the king of the Dacia, loads of different Munster men, Brian's three companions, two kings of the Ivania, loads of different kings. I can't name all of them. Masses of kings. And then it's a king of the Oganucht of Lochlain. The Earl of Mar in Scotland was on his side, according to this, and many other nobles. And then it says, Moel Mura, son of Ochad, successor of Patrick, and his venerable clerics and relics came, moreover, to Sword Columkilla. Is that swords?
That's swords, yeah.
And brought away the body of Brian, king of Ireland, and the body of his son Murchad, and the head of Conning and the head of Muttla, and they buried them in Armagh in a new tomb. For 12 nights, the community of Patrick waked the bodies in honour of the dead king. Okay, super dramatic account.
Probably, actually, in the manuscript, it's actually two, but there's like a mistake with the 12, and everybody says 12. But I mean, it's very interesting, like, yeah, you say that you've got this already, I think, is already being souped up.
Yeah.
You know, because like, oh, buried in a new tomb, I mean, same Jesus on Good Friday, yeah, buried in a new tomb. That's clearly drawing from the Gospels. Yeah. Male Shocknell supposedly there. How is there no Southern Enail dead?
Yeah.
The Meathmen, the West Meathmen, somehow they managed to go to Clontarf. They managed to go very close to Croke Park and come away unscathed. That doesn't happen to Meath and West Meath at Croke Park or anywhere near Croke Park. They come away with a bruising, usually.
Yeah. I think everyone, you're right, everyone has agreed that Moel Shocknell wasn't actually there. So that's really interesting that straight away the Annals of Ulster are placing him anyway as Brian's chief ally.
Yeah, yeah. They're already... Yeah,
and that the King of Tara was recognising Brian as the King of Ireland.
And of course it puts him into the glory of the battle grows, that, you know, that it's adding to the fact that he's glorious by association. He's there.
Like, no one really disagrees that on the day that the victors were kind of Brian and Munster, but
except for the Dubliners.
Yeah.
And Colman Etchingham.
And Colman Etchingham. Okay. Well, because it's not. I mean, there's just a myriad of winners and losers.
What is that counter shock? I mean, does that mean actually they turned back again and they won?
Yeah.
So it's...
Okay. Okay, so you're, we don't know. So we don't know where it took place. We don't know who won. We don't know exactly who was involved. Is everybody's caught up? Okay, great.
So we've agreed we don't know anything.
10:14.
Yeah, 10:14.
10:14. 10:14. So we can just call the movie 10:14 to just.
I mean, who wins? I mean, you could say, okay, even if the Dubliners won the battle, long term, they're finished as a political entity.
Are they though? Because Dublin goes from strength to strength. Economically, Dublin goes
More important, but politically, they never managed to do something like this.
Yeah,
they never managed to be anything more than political bit players.
Okay, so then who becomes afterwards? Then we just read there, three generations of Brian's, you know, himself, his son and his grandson are killed at the battle. His other son, Donnchad, though, he survives.
So Donnchad, apparently, well, if you look at various of the sources, he wasn't present at the battle because according to Cogan and a couple of others, he's sent to burn everywhere else around the place.
Which
is a standard South military tactic. Yeah. You scorch earth everywhere else. So he's given like a third of the army to... Now, the question is that a way of just making an excuse for Donnchad not actually being at the battle? And justify,
but maybe he didn't get there in time. I mean, because he was south of the Liffey at a minimum, wasn't he?
So the whole, and then he turns up, and supposedly he leads the, according to Cogad, he leads the Munstermen through a rough journey home.
Yeah.
But they survive. And he does essentially become the king of Munster for borderline 50 years, which is an achievement in itself.
Yeah, and we don't have time to get into it too much today, but again, just to let everyone know, the kind of the traditional kind of historiography says, but Donnchad wasn't the man that his older brother Murchad was. His half-brother, again, as in they shared a father. But he...
Very easy to celebrate Murchad because Murchad hasn't got any line left after him.
Yeah.
So, like, there's nobody descended from Murchad who can challenge. So, therefore, you can say, oh, Murchad was great.
Yeah, and also I feel like Murchad gets so much respect, rightly, because he led so many military campaigns for Brian Boru, right? Going around Ireland. Like, he's probably intrinsic, you know, he's key to... Obviously, he's his son. But in the later years, leading up to the Battle of Clontarf, Brian is old, and Murchad is probably kind of the military kind of powerhouse there. Yeah. So it's fair enough that it's huge.
He's the heir expected.
It's huge that he gets killed. But then I feel like Donnchad is kind of unfairly put down because he's still the king of Munster, and the O'Brien dynasty, you know, continues to be... Yes, it's not as strong as it was under Brian Boru, but the legacy is massive. And if Donnchad wasn't a strong leader, I don't think it would have panned out.
He kept it on the rails.
Yeah. Which was no mean feat.
No, because there were
Ireland
plenty of others who would have cut the legs from underneath them.
Yeah.
So, I mean, could it all just have easily have fallen apart and all Brian's work fell apart? So, yes, certainly he was no Brian, but at the same time, he didn't have the resources. Because if you look at, like, say, that battle list, I mean, essentially you've got the flower of fighting youth, as it were, dead in 1014. Yeah. So his resources in terms of manpower and fighting power are probably heavily reduced.
Sitrick Silkenbeard, he survives. King Battle, he didn't fight.
Well, that's what they like to say in Cogat. So he's standing on the wall watching.
Yeah.
You're standing on where roughly Dublin Castle is. You're not going to see Clontarf. Let's face it. Then there's the bit like where Brian's daughter, his Sitrick wife, is standing next to him. She says some sly matter.
She's on her dad's side.
She's on her dad's side, yeah. So you notice the women in the story are siding with their paternal family.
Yeah, which again, I think is just literary.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But so Slána is... You're referring to Brian's daughter, who he married off to Sitrick however many years beforehand, after he... defeated Sitrick. This is not the first time Sitrick and Brian have come to blows.
No.
And through kind of repeated military campaigns, Brian gets kind of Sitrick and the Leinstermen as well, who are their kind of closest allies, to submit to him. But they clearly were never happy with it.
No.
And they're building up towards the Battle of Clontarf the whole time.
Let's face it, most of your allies are allies by compulsion.
Yeah.
You know, they're allies but not friends.
But are Leinster and Dublin always fairly solid kind of allies in this period?
It's one of the funny things that how they grow together, considering Dublin was essentially carved out of North Leinster.
Yeah.
in many respects.
Yeah.
And but proximity, neighbors, yeah. the intermarriage.
Yeah.
They have a perhaps a vested interest in allying.
So Citric, the main protagonists are seen as kind of Brian versus Citric. Citric survives, Brian dies. Brian was old anyway, right?
So,
in terms of legacy, he was going to die eventually. So it was kind of made potentially more important about his, his son and everything. Mm-hmm. And objectively speaking, Brian Boru is like one of the greatest Irish people, most famous of all time. And whatever his own personality was like, his achievements, if you count like military domination as achievements, were really impressive. But we can get on to that kind of if we have time in a minute, and we'll definitely have another episode just on Brian himself. But I'm still confused. Okay, we have the Battle of Clontarf, winners and losers. So the battle, we're not even clear exactly where it's fought. We will say Clontarf, 1014. I read out kind of most of what the Annals of Ulster with that contemporary account. What's really significant about that is most of the entries in the Annals are like one phrase or one line. They're super short. This is by far one of the longest, really significant entries. It's recorded in many other of the Annal collections as well. So I think what we can safely say is it is one of the most significant, if not the most significant event, according to contemporaries.
Yeah. It's definitely recognised as... for significance.
Yeah.
They're just not sure what the significance is. Neither are we. But it's significant.
But the winners and losers, let's get on to kind of Muil Seachnall, King of Tara. He's
a winner in many respects. Because, he comes out alive. Yeah. That's always good. And essentially, he kind of not muscles his way, but he kind of regains some of the dominance that he previously had and that he essentially had to cede to Brian. But he dies in 1022.
Yeah.
And his grandson Conchobar, who dies in the 1070s, is the last of the significant Emael Hocknell kings, the last significant southern Enail king. After that, they're circling the drain.
And all the Enail, aren't they? Like northern, and as in like that Enail hegemony is broken. Is it? Well, am I being too binary there? No,
well, I think one of the issues is whether how real was it in the first place?
Ooh.
Their propaganda is effective, and it's pulled the wool over our eyes for centuries in many respects.
Yeah.
That, we're looking at the Enail and they like to pretend they're the big dogs. But how far they can actually influence anything happening outside is questionable. And, did Brian break the, quote-unquote, break the Enail hegemony, or did he expose kind of the fact that it was all smoke and mirrors?
Yeah. Yeah, okay, fair enough. Muil Seachnall, though, himself, as you said, he survives as King of Tara.
Yeah.
So, and he within his own, as you said, for a couple of generations, he has maintained that position. Okay, and then
But Tara's overblown anyway.
Let's face it. Yeah. But Meath,
But the whole idea of the kingship of Tara, it's smoke and mirrors. Because actually, if we look at the last two centuries of the kingship of Tara, so the 11th and 12th century up to the English invasion, the southern Enail are the only ones calling themselves King of Tara. The northern Enail don't care about calling themselves King of Tara. They're calling themselves King of Alech or wherever.
Yeah,
and,
maybe.
And more often than not, the kings of southern Enail are more likely to call themselves kings of Meath rather than they are to call themselves kings of Tara.
So, it is interesting then, though, in terms of legacy, they're often, kind of referred to in certain ways.
But
like they are, you do see that they're trying, there are a number of individuals who are trying to claim themselves as King of Ireland. And it was often the King of Tara was the guy who was really like trying to put forward that claim. Now I'm sure down in Cork, for example, they were like, grand, away with you up there. Yeah, but like, exactly, we don't recognise any of you down here. But maybe the Battle of Clontarf and the, Brian Boru and all that, it exposes kind of a lot of these issues, actually, rather than being a result of them or a symptom of them.
And I would say that probably for many contemporaries, they couldn't tell who was a winner or a loser from something like that. It was, you know, there were bodies everywhere, essentially.
But can we, is it fair in saying that, as you've kind of said, hinted already, that Dublin, that kind of whole Viking presence, it becomes more of an economic and cultural influence after that point. And that they've been trying for 150 years, let's say from the 840s, from Olav and Ivar, who come over in the 840s, and then the descendants of Ivar and everything, they are trying to make inroads into, like, politically into the interior of Ireland. And to perhaps conquer territories, and that's really put to bed.
There's no sense of them really being independent actors. There's nothing like the Battle of Tara, which is only less than a generation earlier. There's nothing like that again, really. Yeah. And as you said, like, you know, economically, they become, I mean, Sitrick prior, about 20 years prior to the Battle of Clontarf, mints the first Dublin money. And Andy Woods, who's the keeper of coins and medals for the York Museum of Museums Trust, has done a lot of work on the coinage in the Irish Sea area. And the coinage runs in the hundreds of thousands of silver pennies, maybe millions.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
From calculating how many dyes were used and the different patterns and over the silver pennies of the century and a half of essentially of Viking Dublin coinage, it becomes one of the major coinages in the Irish Sea region.
So broadly speaking, while I think we can be in general agreement that kind of like Munster, the Brian Boru side kind of wins the Battle of Clontarf, Dublin though is not massively affected. Dublin itself. The actual town, if we're even allowed to call it. I was left
a proto-urban centre or something.
Listen back to the episode with Michael Potterton. But it continues economically, and Sitrick with as the King of Dublin,
and continues exactly. I mean, the town isn't burnt or anything like that, which is the standard thing you do. You always burn somewhere. Whether Dublin lost any territory to anybody? No, because there's nobody really to claim territory as such. So, I mean, in many respects, yes, there's a large battle that happens in it, and it will have suffered effects from that, but it's not devastating to it.
And his alliance then, as you said, you don't get, they're trying for years, as you referenced, 980, Battle of Tara, his dad, Olav Curran, trying to, you know, make a claim, you know, went to battle with the King of Meath. But yes, politically after 1014, or kind of militarily anyway, they're not fighting any big battles. His alliance, kind of military alliance with those other Viking fleets that he brought in, they're not called in again.
No, not really.
But all of the family drama in the Battle of Clontarf, I actually can't cope with. You need a cheat sheet, you know, like it's like reading Anna Karenina or something, as in like you need to have, you know, you need to know exactly, you know, you have to have your notes with you. But talk us through some of the, like, all the different interrelationships. You've mentioned most of them, but let's just talk.
Okay.
People, get out your pen and paper.
Start doing your network diagrams. Yeah. So if we start with the chief female character.
Okay.
So Gormla is the daughter of Murca Mac Finn, who's the King of Lion. She was initially married to Olav Curran, who was the King of Dublin. She had a son with him, Sitrick. Subsequently marries Brian. She has another son, Donica. And finally, supposedly, she marries Mael Shachnel MacDonald, the King of Tara.
She's
and
certainly
has
linked
another
with
son,
him at some point.
Who I think his name is Conchover.
And so her brother.
And then her brother
is
Mael Morda. Mael Morda, King of Leinster.
King of Leinster. She's connected.
Anybody who's fighting there, she's either their sister, mother, or wife.
And actually, funnily enough, she hasn't been given enough credit, kind of since, let's say, Njal saga and stuff in intervening centuries, that she's really, perhaps she was a pivotal player in the whole thing. I mean, the sources give her a big role.
The Norse sources do. And the interesting thing is, she doesn't have the negative image in the Irish sources. That comes from the Norse sources.
Yeah.
And it bleeds back into the English language narratives in Ireland.
Yeah, it does. I think you're right in that Gormla is kind of a starting point in a way of like assessing kind of the different key characters and all the relationships between them. So what we can see is, anyway, that not only are we not exactly sure who was on either side, but that it wasn't as clear cut as the Irish against the foreigners at a minimum. Everyone had been, knew each other well and had been operating in the same political sphere and military sphere for quite a time at this point, and making and breaking different alliances. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Right. Nodding. Nodding. He's nodding there for anybody who can't see him.
I'm nodding very loudly.
Nodding very loudly. You've mentioned the Cogadh Gaeilge Regal a good bit. So I, as I said, I read out kind of one of the contemporary source accounts, the Annals of Ulster. A lot of kind of other things that we've been discussing about, we've kind of learned from the genealogies and different connections between people and stuff. But the Cogadh Gaeilge Regal, and then you also mentioned Njál Saga. Could we talk about them a little bit? Because they have really dominated how we understand what was going on at Clontarf. What is the Cogadh Gaeilge Regal? You said it was the war against the Irish, against the foreigners.
So it's a text that it seems to have been in existence, the various scholars who've worked on this with regard to linguistically dating the text would say the language looks like late 11th, early 12th century.
Okay.
So sometime around 1100, give or take.
So maybe around 100 years-ish after.
Yeah, probably less than a century after it starts off as, with this catalogue of all the Viking terrors against Ireland, the burning here, smiting there, you know, the usual kind of stuff. And Claire Downing has done some good work on this, showing how it's a compressed narrative to make it look like Ireland is an absolute disaster zone of Viking activity until... who comes charging into the rescue? The brave Munster men, and of course it's the Dalgash, the guys from Clare, you know, and they're with their hurleys in hand, you know, to do a smiting. And
I'm sure they did.
Oh, I bet. It kind of builds this idea of a national resistance, a national narrative of resistance against Viking oppression that builds and builds and builds until it reaches this superhero Brian, essentially, who overcomes the odds. Like, you know, they're basically out in the wilderness, like some sort of classical heroes, you know, left with nothing, and then they fight their way back from sticks and stones in the woods to essentially being kings of Ireland.
Yeah.
And then it comes to the second half of the narrative, brings to the Battle of Clontarf, and it's this huge apocalyptic battle. They are the whole, everywhere, everybody is there. It's raining blood and fire, and you name it, the important person is there. And it's this absolute carnage as Brian lays down his life for his beloved country on Good Friday. And of course, the message is, we will rise again.
Until the Anglo-Normans, the English come in the 12th century. Okay, so the most important thing we always have to ask of any source, especially a literary source like
this. Who's writing this and why? Who's getting paid?
Who's getting paid? And who's reading it? Like, so who's writing it, and who are they writing it for?
My theory, which hasn't gained much acceptance, to be honest. I wrote a paper on this, published in the Proceedings of the Royal Irish Academy about maybe a decade ago now as well, is that it's probably written for the descendants of Brian's son, Donacha, who are vying for the kingship of Munster. It's certainly a Munster text, and undoubtedly it's supporting the Dalgash, who become known as the Ivrian or O'Briens, the descendants of Brian. And its success in many respects is that it transcends their needs and their desires for self-glorification. Because the earliest manuscript we have it in is in the Book of Leinster, which of course is a manuscript coming from the people who lost.
Yeah.
So the story becomes too good.
Yeah.
And
or it's there's so much truth in it. You know what I mean? As in, you know, that you can't dispute the kind of the or it, some it of the just, bare facts.
It becomes something that you gotta read, even if you if you don't agree with it, you still gotta read
it's
it.
It's too good. It's too good a story. So, but you're saying that that your theory is that it was written by Brian. So he's the great grandson.
Brian Glenamire.
Yeah. But you're saying that that hasn't gained much traction. But the general consensus would have been that it was written by his brother.
Commissioned by his cousin.
Murkertuck,
who is acknowledged as the King of Ireland.
Yeah.
So they're contemporaries. They occasionally fight, but they're generally actually on side with each other.
Okay.
Trying to figure out who commissioned a text like this is difficult because the narrative stops in 1014. But the way I look at it is the narrative finishes with Donnacha bravely leading the Munster men home. And it's complimentary to Donnacha along the way.
Mm.
But there's no mention of Murkertuck's ancestors. Who descend from another son of Brian.
Mm.
So why would Murkertuck, who is King of Ireland and wants to glorify himself through association with Brian, why would he not have his own line in the text?
Mm.
It doesn't make sense.
And I suppose part of the reason, I don't really know, I haven't read up on a lot of that myself, in fairness, but Murkertuck is such a massive figure after Brian, like, he really creates like the O'Brien legacy and dynasty ecclesiastical, you know, alliances, cooperation, gave the Rock of Cashel to the church, essentially.
He's like recognized from outside Ireland as King of Ireland.
Yeah, as King of
Ireland. In a way that Brian never was.
He's such a big deal that people are like, it's obvious that, you know, it was commissioned from his perspective. But either way, it's one of those kind of cousins. I like your argument though, Dennis. It does make a lot of sense. So it's a really dramatic literary text which is written from just the perspective of the Munsterman. But then the other famous literary account of the Battle of Clontarf is the Norse Njal saga. And what does that say? Because even though it's a Norse saga, it also portrays Brian as this great heroic leader, and it's very much a kind of bias towards Brian as well, isn't it?
Yeah, so Njalsaga is significantly later again than these. I think it's 13th century.
Mm. But it's independent of Cuca, is it?
There must be some... There's definitely information filtering back one way or the other.
Yeah.
But Brian becomes this paradigm of a good Christian king.
Yeah.
And we have to look at Njalsaga in many respects. I think Dr. Rosie Bonte has worked on this in terms of looking at it in the place of the narratives of the Christianization of the Scandinavian world, and how in Njalsaga the bad guys are apostates, and the good guys are even Vikings who are inspired by Christian ideas, even if they're not Christian, they're better guys. So it's very much tied up with the story of the Christianization of the Scandinavian world, and how people who go to Clontarf end up being punished one way or the other.
Okay, we better wrap it up. Listen, this has been really good fun, Dennis. I really wanted to, because of the date, because around April 23rd, and because I love the Battle of Clontarf so much, and because it just draws in so many dramas into it, I really wanted to discuss it today. And thank you for obliging me. I had to slightly twist your arm to come on, and I really appreciate it, and I really enjoyed the chat.
It's been emotional.
Thank you for listening. Please email medievalirishhistory@gmail.com with any questions or comments, or contact us on X at Early Irish Pod. The best way you can support us is by following the show on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, and by rating the show. 5 stars is always appreciated. Thanks.